I am. Good morning, everyone. I'd like to share these opening words from Wendell Berry. When despair for the world grows in me, and I wake in the night at the least sound, in fear of what my life and my children's lives may go, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests, in the beauty of the water and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world, and I am free. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan, Kansas. This morning I ask you not to leave your cares at the door. Do not leave behind your pain, your sorrow, or your joys. Bring them all here today. Bring them into this place of acceptance and forgiveness. Come then and offer yourself to potential transformation by the creative process that flows through you and this progressive community where we share and support and hold one another in times of triumph and failure. In the dark, this is a friendly morning. Every morning's friendly here. I forgot. Please take a moment to greet those around you, and if there's someone new, make a special greeting. Yes. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. I'd like to share these words that will lead us into the lighting of the flaming chalice, our symbol of freedom, hope, and all things that help create wholeness in our lives. In the dark of night, terror draws near, nameless fears attack. Hopelessness expands, the abyss of fear, alone and unknown in the gloom, longing for the dawn. O sacred flame of truth, blaze forth, wisdom brought to life. Guide us with the light of hope, the warmth of love, the beacon of purpose and meaning, because we are afraid at times of the darkness that claims our better selves. Let there be light. Now let us stand as you're able and sing our opening hymn, number 44. We sing of golden mornings.
Thank you.
I draw your attention to the announcements in our order of service, and I would like to lift up something that will be happening next Sunday in the Kansas City Star Parade magazine, the lawsuit that Charles and I are a part of to fight for marriage equality in the state of Kansas will be the featured article. So hopefully the pictures aren't too bad, but... So look for that and help us continue with that effort. Ours is a welcoming community where we find connection, a loving community where we find meaning. Ours is a sharing community where our joys are amplified, a caring community where our sorrows are lessened. We take this moment to reflect on our personal joys and sorrows and acknowledge the mutual support of this community in the many ways it does its work. If you would like, please share a brief verbal expression of a special joy or sorrow, or a mix.
Shirley Hobrock. We had a great time last night at Jen and Matt Campbell's, and I'd like to thank them. They're not here this morning yet.
I think they're at Costco.
Anyway, Jen and Matt and Alex Stinson and Sarah Lott all hosted a beer-making and pizza-making party, and we'd just like to thank them. They did a great job. It was a lot of work, and I think everybody there had a great time. It was outside and great fall thing to do. We hope if we do it again, we get more people that can enjoy it.
Hey, my name is Richard Thompson, and I've been asked here to speak about mental illness, and I just want to say that that's a joy to discuss the issue that's very personal to me, and to be here with Michael, Chuck, and my wonderful parents.
I'm Sylvia Beeman. I want to thank everyone who came to work day. It was wonderful. I always think nobody's coming. And then when I wrote this list, there were 17 people. Kathleen and Michael Oldfather, Sandy Nelson, Shirley Hobrock, Chris Bailey, Marjean Moss, and Carolyn, I think, brought some cookies. Not positive. Jennifer Bryan, Jean Sievers, Elka Lorenz, Scott Tanona, and Rose and Ronan were wonderful. Dick Beeman, Drew, and our youngest helper, Xavier Venom. Yes, a one-year-old can do things. And Ken Embers. And I also want to thank Mark Clark, Matt Campbell, Mark Mayfield, Tom Manny, and Doug Walter, who do facilities things all year round and every day and come in the middle of the night in all kinds of weird times and keep our building so nice for us to enjoy. Thank you, all of you.
Leah Sarah, I have a joy that my mom's friend Eugene is here. Please stand up, Eugene.
All right, Eugene. Yes, I think so.
Hello, I'm Charles. I just wanted to report a joy in that I have now finished a complete mom circuit. I had earlier driven Michael's mother to Pennsylvania and back so they could visit each other. And now my mother's not so able to get around, so I flew out to Pennsylvania, got in her car, and drove her out here to Kansas. We walked all over, went all over the place, stopped off in Hannibal, Missouri, where relatives apparently are pushing up daisies. And otherwise, it was a good trip, a long trip, but it was a lot of fun. So I'm happy about that.
You can hear my story later.
Sybil Perkins, I don't think it can go unnoted, the joy that was swept through so many states and the country this last week when the Supreme Court denied overturning the stays. So seems like change is even coming to Kansas.
I have one to announce. Barbara Hacker was supposed to have a pacemaker put in Friday, but it didn't get done because of some medication and she has a bad cold. So they're supposed to do it tomorrow. So I think she expects to be home, if not the first day, the second day.
Yeah. Okay, thank you, everyone. May we remember those who have spoken, those they have named, and all the joys and sorrows we hold in our heart that go unspoken. Let us be mindful. Let us take the time to look each other in the eye. All right, kids, I need your help. Come on up. I don't know what's in there. We'll find out. Okay, can everyone hear me? All right, great. So when you guys were little, were you afraid of the dark?
I'm still afraid.
You're still afraid of the dark? Okay, right. So when I was about 4, I remember having a dream in which I was going up in the sky and all of a sudden a witch with a dark black foldy flying thing, and it had spider webs all over her dress and her hair, and it was just sticking out, and she had this mean ugly broom that could just sweep anybody out of the way, and she got me on the back of the broom, and I had to hold that spider webby black thing, and I was like, and I woke up screaming. And then I was very afraid after that of my closet. And so every single night before I went to bed and turned the light out, I opened the closet door. My mother, of course, liked to have the closet door shut, but I needed to make sure there was no witch in that closet because I was sure that's where that witch had come from. And then somehow I saw this great story about a tiger with a big mouth and big sharp teeth that could just take you right in its mouth and make you into a little morsel. And so then every single night, now I also had to check for that tiger who I knew like to hide in the dark, waiting for me to go to sleep so it could take me away. It could take me into the jungle and just tear me up. Oh, I was so afraid, and I just didn't know what to do every single night. More things were in that closet, and I just had to keep on checking to make sure nothing was in there that would get me, that would keep me from being safe. And then one day, I don't know how this happened, because I didn't tell my parents I was so afraid, because I thought, well, that would be kind of silly, because I was supposed to be grown up at 5 and 6, you know, right? I mean, you're supposed to be grown up already. You're not supposed to be afraid of those kinds of things. But my father brought me a gift. And I always kept it wrapped because it likes to stay warm and cuddly and sweet. And so he gave me my very own tiger. And so this tiger would purr when I was trying to go to sleep and would say, "It's okay. I'm here. I'll take very good care of you. You don't have to worry." So I found that having this stuffed toy to talk to and to hold under the covers. Help me feel safe. And even as we grow older, and when we become really old, like 13, 12, 14, we still have fears. You know, finding a place in the lunchroom. Where are you going to sit? Who is going to sit with you? Those things can be really scary, right? I mean, they can. They can make you feel, oh, okay, I can do this, right? So we all need something in our lives, no matter how old we are, like this tiger who has been with me for 56 years. And he reminds me that I need something to help me feel safe. And sometimes it's Chuck. Sometimes it's a friend. Sometimes it's my kitty. Sometimes it's my dog. You should always find something to help you when you're afraid. And if you are being bullied or told that you're a bad person or a stupid person, remember that the Unitarian Universalist Church believes that love is the most important thing. Know that you are loved. You are loved by everyone here, and that we hope to help you if you're ever in need. So I hope you have your own tigers in your life that help you every day. Thanks a lot.
Go to learn in love, shine your light in all you do.
Judy Davis is here for our Helping Hands Sunday to present her reasons why we should consider giving to the Crisis Center. Welcome, Judy.
Good morning. Glad to be here again. Thank you for all of your past support. Michael has suggested that I divert from my own script, and I'm going to try. Many of you know the Crisis Center was incorporated in 1981 to serve victims of sexual and domestic violence in our five-county community. We served then not just Riley County, but Clay, Gary, Marshall, and Pottawatomie. And I will share with you one fairly recent and especially vivid example of the Crisis Center's work for safety and justice for victims of domestic violence. Some months ago, we received a crisis call, and we receive about 2,500 of those every year, from a young woman who was hysterical, mother of three children, two of them preschool age. She had been beaten again and thrown from her home again. And this time he promised he was going to take the children and move them three states away. This young woman, an exquisitely competent parent, also suffered from a pretty serious physical disability. She got herself to the home of a friend who had herself relied upon the Crisis Center and so knew our number. And this is what 24-hour crisis intervention and advocacy looked like. She called. We responded immediately. When we learned of his plan to take the children and leave the state, and if there is no custody order in place, there is not a thing our wonderful local law enforcement folks can do. They are children of the state of Kansas, not of Jane or John Doe. And so while we usually help victims on our own petition for protection orders because those procedures are meant to be done pro se, in this instance we wanted to be sure everything was done absolutely right. And so we called our allies at Kansas Legal Services, and Paul Shipp himself stepped up, and early in the morning we were in the courtroom and Judge Stutzman, God love him, was not amused, and he granted her full custody. By the time that order, that temporary protection order, was served, he had already withdrawn the school-age child from school, and he was packing the car. That's why we do what we do. And we do it only with the support of a wonderful, wonderful, compassionate community. Thank you.
As we receive the offering, we're going to hear a composition written by Renee Reasoner and performed by Renee Reasoner, Hello, Ghost.
Hi. You wear gloves when you touch the world, and that's if you touch the world at all. Why touch anything? Seems like everything cuts you up and takes its toll. You might disagree, but I have no doubt that one day all the stars will go out. And if that's so, all your pain will go. So I choose to hide when you've already died. Hello, ghost. Hello, old friend. I found you inside when I found my end. Hello, ghost. You're in my mind. Why should I hide when I know you're inside? I stood still, watched the train go by, long dark tracks leading through the sky. Silent speaking lips, words that can't sink ships, it's too much, but I won't cry. You might disagree, but I have no doubt that one day all the stars will go out. And if that's so, all your pain will go. So why choose to hide when you've already died? Hello, ghost. Hello, old friend. I found you inside when I found my end. Hello, ghost. You're in my mind. Why should I hide when I know you're inside? Hello, ghost. Hello, ghost. Hello, ghost.
Thank you, Renee. Breaking the silence around mental illness is one of the last, well, there are probably many, but one of the last areas of human rights that fully needs exposure. And each of us know that we have experienced times in our life when we have felt great depths of despair, we have been depressed, we have felt incredibly anxious. Things don't make sense. They just don't come together. And we need help at those times. We need a community that supports us, will hold us, will care for us, will say, you can make it. I can remember when I was 6 years old at the Methodist church that I was a member of in church school, and we had the greatest church school teacher, Mrs. Marsh. She was the sweetest human being you could ever imagine, And she didn't rule with an iron fist. She ruled with love and kindness, and she was just the best. And then one day she wasn't there. And I found out that her husband, who had been working on his car jacked up in the driveway, she was in the kitchen fixing lunch. This is back in the late 50s, early 60s. She came out and she found her husband pinned under the car, dead. She was inconsolable. There was nothing that could bridge her back to hope. So she took her life. And so at an early age, I began to understand that people could become so sad and so lost that their life was not worth living. So that stayed with me, and I think sensitized me to bullying, how kids were ostracized because they may have been effeminate or fat or very smart and nerdy or had a funny way of walking, whatever it was, that kids could always be made to feel like they did not belong. And I felt rage and tried to do what I could to protect them. And then when I went to divinity school, it was the first time that I actually learned a lot about mental health, that there were people that actually went to psychiatrists and therapists. Of course, I knew this through other ways, but I didn't know that this was something ordinary people could avail themselves to, that you could go to a therapist and you could talk about your problems and you could get great feedback. You could begin a dialogue of healing. What an amazing journey. And during that time, I worked for the homeless shelter and the battered women's shelter in Berkeley, and there I saw every kind of mental affliction you could possibly imagine. Vietnam War vets who were not fully diagnosed, were not being taken care of, full-blown PTSD, paranoia, running around the streets of Berkeley, just going crazy, people who had just fried their brains on drugs, other people who had schizophrenia, bipolar, who were not being diagnosed, who had no treatment, and the social services couldn't handle them because they could not behave in front of a social worker. They couldn't behave, so then they couldn't get care. Duh, they need more care. So anyway, I grew in my understanding to the depths of my being how poor of a job we do in this country in terms of caring for those people who do not have strong families, who do not have people in their lives that will keep on saying, come on, we can do this, we can do this. Without those support networks, these people literally fall through the cracks. They're living under bridges. They're living in cardboard boxes in the United States of America. Well, there is a long history of how we have poorly treated mentally ill people. From about the time of Jesus till 1700, except through the Middle Ages, things really turned nasty. There was a kind of hopefully benevolent view of how to take care of people who weren't quite right. But in the Middle Ages, it began to be seen as a real sin, as something that the devil had planted in that person, and so they needed to be whipped. They needed to be put in the market naked. They needed to be put on a pyre and lit and burnt. This is how we treated people with mental illness. And then in the 19th century, in the 17th century, the Age of Reason and the Enlightenment and all that kind of stuff, things began to go from the religious to a more medical, benevolent, fraternal model where we're going to help those people, but we're not going to give them the keys to the door. We're just going to keep them blocked up somehow. We're not going to fully emancipate them, help them become productive, creative members of society, but we're going to be nice and good. And then in the 19th century, Dorothea Dix, whom many of you have heard me talk about before, was the person who started the first mental asylums where people were not left naked in the cold, because they thought leaving someone mentally ill naked in the cold below zero would cure them. So, but she tried to provide a safe place for people, and she campaigned from state to state, and in her 30 years of working on this, she created about 30 to 40 places, safe places to go. But as the bureaucracy took over, the first place that money was taken from was mental health. And so they became lockup zones for people that no one wanted on the street. They didn't want them in their house. So the whole spiraling in and out of trying to figure this out and collapsing into, no, let's demonize these people. It's a long trajectory. It's a very complicated story, and I'm glossing over it very quickly. But I do remember this. In my first stint as a minister back in the 80s, I worked with people from Central America who had been tortured because they were teaching Native people, indigenous people, how to read. They were tortured to the extent that they would lose their whole identity. They had no personhood left. They didn't even know their name, and they were sent out of, they would flee the country, and they would come here without any bearings, with this obsessive loop that I'm bad, that I'm bad, that I'm bad, that I'm bad. Why did I let my wife be killed in front of me? Those kinds of things. But what I learned as I worked with survivors of torture, that if you provide a safe place where they can begin to tell their story, to trace their journey, they can begin to regain their identity. They can begin to see who they were and begin to find their place in the world. And as they gained in that recognition of their own self-worth, the obsessive cycles would lessen, and a real person could again emerge. Well, this got incredibly personal, 16 years ago, 15 years ago? Richard, I've known since he was in the womb. I've known him forever. And I met with him when you were 15. You were getting your Boy Scouts badge of honor. And we were just talking. You, what? Eagle Scout. Okay. And so we talked in my backyard for an hour and a half about all these great things. He was on top of the world, and he was just going to take it by the horns and ride it and do everything possible to make the world a better place. And today he is doing that, but it's been a long journey. And it is my incredible honor. To welcome Barbara Thompson and Richard Thompson, and to recognize Mark Thompson as being true heroes.
Wow. You know, that's mean, Michael. You know how emotional I am. To make me cry before I even get up here. That's really, really mean. And I have to turn my cup this way because it has an evil Jayhawk on it. I didn't realize that till I walked in here and I thought, oh dear, that's not the right cup to have here. My name is Barb, as Michael said, and I have been friends with Chuck and Michael for a very long time, probably over 30 years. We've been through a lot together. And he asked me to come here today and talk about our journey with mental illness. I'm not an expert on mental illness. I've learned a lot about it and about how our society and a medical profession treats mental illness, but I'm definitely not an expert. So I don't profess to be. I can just tell you what we've been through. And hopefully if any of you have family or friends or anybody that's in your life that has, either you suspect might have some affection with mental illness or might be hinting at that, this might help you see it in a little bit different way. I feel actually really lucky that if this was going to happen in my family, that I've had the support that I've had. But it has been a very big roller coaster ride for all of us. As Michael said, Richard was a kind of kid when he was little who was really smart. He still is. He cares very much about other people, cares very much about what's going on in the world. He's a dynamic person. He sets goals for himself. When he was 17, he had just been elected class president for the following year for his senior class. And he started to act really different. And, of course, he's 17. So you think, and I'm a teacher of 33 years. I just retired a few years ago. I've seen all kinds of things with kids. And when a kid's 17, if you've ever had a teenager in your house, you know they act really weird. And so when he started having some really different behaviors, we thought, my husband and I thought, yeah, he's just 17, you know. No. They go through these things. It's very hard at that age to recognize what might be something more serious and what might be just a kid going through his teen years and going through ups and downs, because they can look almost the same. Just to give you a little bit of background, I now realize, because of all the reading I've done about mental illness and because of being around Richard and going to doctors and conversing with them about illnesses of the mind, that my mom had bipolar disorder. I'm sure she did. She was never diagnosed. She never went to a doctor, never took any medication for it. And she was really, in a lot of ways, a wonderful mother, but she definitely had big mood swings. And I never thought it was that unusual, because, you know, when you're a teenager, you talk to your friends and other girls you know, and they say, my mom drives me nuts, you know, she's always mad at me. So I always thought that everybody's moms were like that. But I now know that my mom, I'm almost positive, had bipolar disorder. And there were other mental illnesses on her side of the family. My husband also has depression on his side of the family, and he's suffered from depression from time to time. So Richard comes by it naturally. It wasn't anything he did. It wasn't anything. Something probably triggered it in him, but I'm not even sure what that was. But at 17, he definitely had some issues, and we finally, without going into all detail that will take us here forever, he had three major episodes with mental illness that were bad enough to put him in the hospital. At 17, eventually that summer after his junior year, he was in and out of the hospital that summer. At 19, when he came back from his first year of college, he had gone out of state, which probably was a risky thing to do when you already know you have mental illness, but we kind of wanted him to pursue his dreams, and he came back and he had another episode. And then at 22, he had a big major episode. He was going to school at UMKC, and that's when we found out he didn't just have bipolar disorder. He had what's called schizoaffective disorder, which is elements of schizophrenia and elements of mood disorder combined. And my understanding of it is, and maybe Richard can tell you better, is that it's not, neither one are full-blown. It's not full-blown schizophrenia. It's not full-blown they call bipolar 1. But it's elements of both combined together, which makes it very complicated. We've been through suicide attempts. Luckily, they never material. They never were successful, both in high school and in college. And it was a real roller coaster ride. And I a lot of times didn't know how to navigate the system. I will say that we kind of put off having him go to a doctor for a little while, like I said, because he was a teenager. We thought that maybe he was just going through a stage. I would say don't put it off if you are around it or if you have somebody. Go, because number one, getting into the system is so difficult. The mental health care system is completely broken. I don't know if any of you have had to navigate it. It is horrible. It's absolutely horrible. And but you have to get yourself in there quickly because it might take you a while to actually get seen or get some help. And even once you get help, it takes a while to find a medication that works if you need medication, which you probably do if it's a severe illness. And then the medication they put you on sometimes doesn't work, and they take you off that one, they put you on another one, and then you find out a few months later that doesn't work. And it's a real, real a long process of trial and error. And it's a very disjointed process. I could go on and on about navigating the healthcare system. But you do want to find help. You do want to get in or get your loved one in or your friend in if they will go. We were lucky, I'll talk about this in a minute, because of who Richard is, he always went. He didn't fight us on it. I think when he got really seriously ill, he knew he needed to go, and so he went. And that's not the case with a lot of people who are mentally ill. They don't want to go, or they don't think they have a mental illness. That's part of the mental illness, is they think they're fine. Or if they're manic, they like the mania. They like that feeling of, boy, I feel great. I can do anything. I can stay up till 5 a.m. and, get all these things done and be creative. And so we didn't really have that situation. So that in that we were lucky. There's a lack of coordination in the mental health care system that's unbelievable. You have your psychiatrist over here, and you have a counselor maybe over there. And if you're lucky and you have enough resources and you actually have health insurance and you have somebody to advocate for you, like we have tried to do for Richard, you actually can navigate that system kind of. But there's a lot of people out there that don't have a support system or anybody to advocate for them. And those people are really out, like Michael said earlier, out literally out in the cold. They don't, because if you already have a mental illness, you can't navigate anyway. And then add on top of that you're trying to navigate a system that's completely messed up and disjointed. And it's, for a person who doesn't have a mental illness, it's harrowing. I mean, I can't tell you the times I've, gotten off the phone and cried because the healthcare system is so messed up. And I feel like you have to fight to be in it and to get what you need. And oftentimes, if you're mentally ill, you can't do that. You don't have the capacity. As far as surviving this whole thing, I think a sense of humor is really important. Sometimes we laugh about things that probably most people wouldn't laugh about. That's kind of how I cope with things, is make fun of them and be sarcastic. And so that's kind of my coping mechanism, is to use humor. And that's kind of what we use in our family. Richard has this he'll tell you about it, I'm sure, this ongoing battle with one of the medications he takes. He has to have his blood drawn every month, and they have to check something in his blood to see if it's okay. So between the insurance company, the pharmacy, his doctor's office, and there's another entity too. The what?
The lab.
Oh, the lab that draws it. They're all working in their own little silos, and somebody always, inevitably, every month, somebody screws up. And he has to go out finding where it is and where the mix-up is before he runs down to his last pill, and it's just harrowing. The things he's had to go through. I used to help him with it when he was younger, and now he kind of does it all himself, and then he comes back, and we just sit and laugh about it, about what so-and-so said to him at the pharmacy that we know is not true, and that's kind of how we get through it, is our sense of humor. Counseling is absolutely critical, and sometimes finding a good counselor is hard to do. One that helps other people doesn't always... you don't always click with. But I'll also tell you that if you're a person who's dealing with somebody who's mentally ill in your family or a friend that's mentally ill, you need counseling too. I went to a counselor when Richard was in high school, and she absolutely got me through the crisis. She was amazing. You have to have somebody there to help you and she fortunately knows the system. And she was able to hook him up with a psychiatrist who had actually talked to his counselor and communicate with him. That usually doesn't happen. Psychiatrists don't want to mess with that. They actually talk to each other. The best care Richard ever got was at Johnson County Mental Health, the county mental health institution, because they worked as a team. And everybody there worked on, you know, you had a psychiatrist, a counselor, a vocational advocacy person, you know, everything he needed was there on the team. And you wouldn't think a county mental health care system would be better than the private system, but it is. So when they say that the ACA isn't going to work, I say, yeah, it is. Yeah, I've seen it. I've seen, you know, publicly funded mental health work far better than private mental health. In that note, I want to say, be sure you vote. And be sure you vote for the right people. It really does matter who's in charge. It really does matter. They make all the laws and they make all the rules, and they really can make or break people who have physical illness or mental illness. I kind of liken this to when I believe that when LGBT people in our country, when they really started to... there started to be an awareness was when they started to come out, the whole Harvey Milk, you know, coming out thing. And it was scary and stuff, but that's when the wheels really started to turn for real. And I think actually with mental health, that's true too. Until we share with each other that we have a mental illness, or I understand what you're going through because I've had depression too. I had a couple friends that helped me a lot, because they had mental illness or they'd had it in their family, and they helped me understand it and feel like I wasn't alone. You can't do this by yourself. You'll end up with a mental illness if you're a caretaker because it's so difficult to do, and there's so much stigma surrounding it. And luckily, I didn't have to fight Richard on it because he would go and do what he needed to do, and he's very responsible about... he can never drink. He's 28 years old, can't have an alcoholic beverage. What do all 20... I'm sorry, when I was 28... I knew Chuck pretty well when I was 28. We did a lot of drinking. And I know it's got to be hard on him, but he sticks to the plan, and he doesn't divert from it. And it's got to be hard because everybody his age is going to the bars and drinking and having a good time and partying and everything. So he makes it easy. The system makes it hard, and the stigma and the isolation for me, this is just me personally, makes it hard. But luckily my husband is a great provider, and he provides a lot of resources. In both, you know, we always have had insurance. We've always had all the money that we're not rich, but the money that we need to pay for things. We don't have to worry about that. That's not true with a lot of people either. They totally have to worry about the money, or they can't go get their meds because they don't have the money to pay the copay, or they don't have insurance to pay. A lot of mentally ill people don't have insurance. A lot of them can't even work. And so, I've been lucky. Yes, it's been hard for me, but if it's hard for me and I have all these advantages, imagine what it's like for people that don't have all those advantages. It's got to be harrowing. Richard met a a person his age, a friend at Johnson County Mental Health when he used to go there, and he has Asperger's syndrome, and he's come over a lot for dinner, and we've gotten to know him, and his parents are deceased, even though he's only in his late 20s. His parents died like a long time ago when he was in his teens, early teens. And he has no support system. His sister lives in Kansas City where he lives, but is minimally supportive. He absolutely has nobody. So we've kind of been trying to help him along the way when he needs it or when he asks for it. But he lived with us for a little while when he really needed someplace to live. And so I've tried to remember that, to reach out to other people who don't have all the advantages that we have and help them. And I know all of you can do that. I see what a great family you have here and the support that you show each other. So I know you can provide that support for people maybe who don't have family members that can help support them, or their family members won't really support them. I hope you will do that. I think that's one thing that's really needed. The whole struggle has taught me a lot about the power of perseverance and persistence and tenacity, because if you don't have that, you'll never make it through the system. And support from friends and family or church members, church friends, fellowship. And just, you know, being there for people. Remember, I had a meeting one time when I was a teacher, and it was a meeting where two teachers got in a real big argument, and I remember afterwards the principal said to all of us, "You don't know what anybody in the school walks into the school with, what's in their baggage, what's in their background, what happened that day before, the night before, the morning they walked in." So, and it turned out she had more information. She obviously couldn't share. She just knew that these two people were both struggling, one with a mental illness and her family, and one with some different alcoholism, but they were just on edge, and I think we just all need, when somebody exhibits those kind of behaviors, you just need to step back and think, why, I wonder why this is happening. Maybe I could reach out to them and find out what's going on in their life, because oftentimes there is something, maybe it's not a mental illness, maybe it's something else, but that's kind of what it's taught me. Maybe there's reasons for people when they behave and you think, God, they're being a jerk, you know. No, they're not. There's something going on there that's really, really hurting them. So I've talked way too long, I know, but I want to turn it over to Richard, and he can tell you from his perspective what mental illness and what supportive things are helpful to somebody who is struggling with it.
I have to say, my parents are wonderful. I'm Richard. As my mom said, have been recovering from bipolar disorder. At times, it's been very, very rough. Two things have helped me survive this. One was having the courage to help myself. The other was being able to reach out both to my parents and my sister and to professional help. First, I'd like to talk a little bit about the stigma of having bipolar disorder. I've often joked with friends that I am bi in several ways. I am both bisexual and bipolar. There is sort of a continuous process of coming out if you have bipolar disorder, and it's a lot like being bisexual. However, sometimes it's more difficult to come out as being bipolar than it is as being bisexual. I've been told that everyone wants a little pill to make all the problems go away. I've been told all kinds of things like that. And for a time, it sometimes made me feel very bad about having a mental illness. But I realized over time that chemical imbalances in your brain, if that's what your mental illness is, or anything else, really, are a medical condition like any other. My sister has type 1 diabetes, and no one says to her, well, why don't you just get over it? Quit injecting insulin. Likewise, I should not tell myself, you know, just get over it, don't take your pills. Anyway, the professional help, both therapeutic and through chemistry, have really helped me. Getting the chemistry right, as my parents could tell you, has been a huge help. And my challenge to those of you that are victims of mental disorders is to seek that help, both professional and personal. Now, I'm going to echo with what my mother said and say that the healthcare system in this country is very weak right now. I've had, I think, my most recent, my mom alluded to a medication I take called clozapine, and it's an antipsychotic. And my experience with that, every month I have to get my blood drawn. Blood has to go to the doctor. Doctor has to send it to the pharmacy. Then I have to go pick it up. Last time I went into the pharmacy, and they said, well, we don't have your blood work yet, I don't think. So I said, can you go back and check again? And she went back and checked, and several minutes later she comes out and says, actually, we do have it. So why don't you just wait here, and we'll fill it for you? Well, after quite some time, I got up and said, what's going on with my medication? There's nobody else here. And they said, oh. And she got on the computer and said, we don't have any prescriptions left for you. So it can be very frustrating at times, but there are really good people out there in the mental health profession. Also, you know, a lot of you may be asking, you know, what can I do as a family or friend of someone with mental illness? The biggest thing is just to show them unconditional love and compassion. They may do things at times that are not appropriate because they have these chemical imbalances. And while they do need to take responsibility for that, try to show as much understanding as you can. Some of the things you can do, being demonstrative about how much you love your other loved ones is very important. I can remember my father, when I got out of the hospital when I was 22, would leave me notes talking about how much he loved me and the things he loved about me and such, and that really helped me recover. It really meant a lot to me to sit there in the morning, you know, and just read these wonderful notes. Really, really helped me with my self-esteem issues. And you know, sometimes unless you're a trained psychiatrist or psychologist, you may not know what to say, but just by listening to someone with a mental illness, it will help them. I promise you that. If you have someone that's under 18, advocating for them can really help. Sometimes it even still happens, but my mother and my father would often advocate for me with the mental health officials, with my doctor's office, a psychiatrist, psychologist. I can remember my mother on the phone and in person arguing with my psychiatrist's office about when I could next get in. So that's also very helpful. So anyway, just to sum up, have the courage to seek help, and those of you that they reach out to for help, treat them with love and compassion and not judgment. And I hope that everything works out for those of you that do have those issues going on. Mom and Dad, I love you. Without you too, I would not be here today. Chuck and Michael, I love you too. Thank you so much for giving me this wonderful opportunity.
It's always an inspiration to me that when people who suffer deeply, whether from a mental affliction or a loss they cannot ponder and build the bridges back into their heart so that they can really feel centered and whole, they persevere, they find a way, and they make something of their lives. To watch Richard and his family move through these last 14 years has been a hair-raising, heartwarming, and an ongoing education of the most profound and important kind, because it has been love, as Richard said, that has been their guide. So whatever problems that you have in your life, let love be your guide. It will take you someplace better than despair. So we have a few moments. If you'd like to share, this is the time to do so.
Is this working?
Yeah.
As the handler of the talking stick, I want to ask that Michael or whomever is standing up there point out the next person.
Okay, we'll do that.
We'll start here with Kristen.
Thank you very much for that moving discussion. It's Kristen Corwin.
Do you want to come up, guys?
I've interacted mostly with people with mental illness that I know of who are my students. I am a faculty member. And I know you were going to college, and I'd like to hear, hopefully good stories about things that people you talked to, did you come out to your faculty members, and did they support you, and is there things that we can do when students come to us with mental illness?
That's an excellent question. I came out to some, but not others. I actually was a psych major, so with my professors, I had some empathy. People in those professions, college professors, tend to be more friendly to it anyway, but especially those that are psychologists. It's difficult for someone in your situation to know what to do because you don't want to, you know, just go up to somebody and say, hey, so are you bipolar? but if someone approaches you, then, you know, again, just... You know, I don't know what your background is, but if you don't have, you know, a doctorate in psychology, I would say just, you know, listen as much as you can and, you know, offer sympathy and not judgment. There might be, you know, a time where if someone's exhibiting certain behaviors, you might say, are you all right, or do you want to talk about something? But it is a tricky situation, so...
Ann Cohen, I just wanted to let others here know that I just completed a course with Pawnee. It's called Mental Health First Aid. It was 2 4-hour sessions, and it is free. They offer it several areas around here, and I think they offer it every year. Some of you might be interested, and it's basically recognizing that there may be a problem and the best approaches to such people for totally lay people with no professional skills, and the best approaches and the worst approaches that you can have toward these people. So any of you who are interested in that, you might see when they're offering it again. They offer it throughout the area.
That would be an excellent thing for you to check out.
For those in case safe, there's half-day safe self-training.
Good.
Aquina Stanton. My mother suffered from mental health issues, went through a lot of psychiatrists, very expensive. Our family moved a lot to be around, to be in the professional place, the right place. She finally admitted herself to the state hospital, and that's where they found the chemical balance, because people were saying, well, just back up and get over it. You know, people don't recognize that mental health is a, you can have prostate cancer and nobody thinks anything of it, but if you have a mental health condition, you're supposed to just get over it. My family survived because we had community. I'm sorry. And my mother's friends. When I was a freshman, took me out to buy my prom dress because my mom was in the hospital. So thank you for being up to me. Sorry.
Thank you for sharing that.
Hi, I'm Charlie Kempthorne. It's a noble and brave thing you folks do. I send you greetings from a previous generation of the mentally ill. I became a full-time patient at the Menninger Clinic in 1962. That's a long time ago. I was there 4 years. They didn't do a 28-day rehab thing in those days. I was a full-time patient for a year, and for 3 years I was in something they called the day hospital. It was a wonderful hospital, and by the way, Kansas at that time had probably the best mental health system anywhere, and Menninger certainly was one of the best hospitals in the world, so I was a very lucky guy in that. But I left after 4 years, and they didn't say, you know, you're cured, Charlie, go out there and conquer the world. They said, maybe you should stay, you know, we really would like to analyze you a little more. But I left. I had other fish to fry, and I was functional. You know, in those days, they didn't have labels. Menninger specifically was very much opposed to labels. I was just called an anxiety patient. And so they didn't have medication either. I once asked for an aspirin for a headache, and Dr. Bernardis, who was a wonderful person, now dead, a beautiful lady, she said, well, why do you have a headache, Mr. Kempthorne? You know, that was the approach at that time for a guy like me. And we used to have a saying that because we were all together, about 200 patients in that clinic at the time, and we all came to know one another, and some of us were severely psychotic and some of us were not. And I suppose I certainly wasn't psychotic exactly. We used to say, neurotics build sandcastles in the air. Psychotics live in them. And I was a builder most of the time, but there were times when I would cross over. And I want to say, I didn't, as I started to say earlier, I was not cured, but I learned to live with it. And at some time, you know, you get pretty miserable. And after about 20 years of that, I began to think, you know, maybe this is a blessing. I'm just looking at the telescope or whatever the metaphor is. I'm looking at things through the wrong end. And I look at things sometimes that way now. Sometimes I don't. Most of the time now I do. I became a writer. Well, I was a writer when I went in. And I've kept a journal, and I've thought, you know, it's 18,000 words and 18,000 pages, 9 million words. And much of it is about, it's an attempt to say, look, I may be crazy, but this is my craziness, and this is what I've lived with, and in some ways, I'm glad, and I'll stop with one thing. I have six children, and five of them are normal. They're all beautiful and brilliant, of course. Five of them are normal. One is much more like me, except that I think he's a genius. Artistically, I think that's not just parental pride. I'm not an art expert. I'm not a psychiatry expert. But I've looked at a lot of art, and when I walk into the gallery, what Ben has done is stuff very much like the stuff I see him doing. But his life has been very troubled. Now, Barbara, you spoke of mental patients who won't seek care, and he is one of those. And I don't know what we can do in this kind of climate with that kind of thing. But anyway, I'll shut up. And
okay, we have time for Fred, and then we need to stop. No, wait. Fred, and then
Sylvia. First off, I want to thank Barbara and Richard for sharing their story.
You're welcome.
I am part of a family that has had a lot of mental illness. We lived through a suicide. My dad is also bipolar, was never diagnosed or got any treatment for it until he went to the nursing home, so you can imagine. I do want to say one thing about the treatment. I have my own problems with anxiety, and I've managed to treat mine without drugs most of the time because I prefer not to be chemically dependent. But I stay away from other things. I stay away from alcohol. I stay away from caffeine, all the other things that some other people can do and I don't do. I stay away from it. But mostly I treat my anxiety with just counseling because I prefer not to be chemically dependent.
Counseling is definitely a good route to go.
Sylvia. Thanks for talking to us. I greatly appreciate your openness. And between my husband's and my family's, we have pretty much every mental illness covered. And ironically, my father was a psychiatrist, and our mother, we came to understand much later, was probably bipolar. And lots of problems in our family. We're pretty nutty. But one of our daughters in particular has struggled with anxiety and depression since she was maybe 12 or 14, and she has not been one who will accept any help. But just like you, we anguish with what kind of treatment was available when she would be having a crisis. We could never get her in anywhere. And this is my brightest kid. She's very creative and very smart. And I dragged her to probably 9 psychologists and counselors and psychiatrists. They all said she was fine. So she has finally, now that she's 26, sought help herself. She's doing much better. And I've always tried to tell my kids that, like I do, so a part of me is an artist, and my husband too, and that we use our mental anguish in a creative way to express ourselves, which is why I really started being an artist. And I really empathize with all the things you said and all the stigma. And I work with all young people, all much younger than me, and a lot of them have helped me immensely. One of the young women told me she was diagnosed as a schizophrenic. She's quite open about it. And she told me that she wants to show the world that a schizophrenic can be a functioning person. And she is a difficult person, but I love her dearly. And I learned so much from her. And 2 other young people told me that from when they were very young, they were diagnosed with various mental disorders and were heavily medicated. And then for both of them, they were honest enough to tell me their odysseys. And we had just frank discussion. They both had big family conferences and managed to get off their medications. And they're just a joy to work with. And then I talked to someone at Workday yesterday, which one of the beauties of Workday is other things that happen. She struggled with mental illness for decades and finally found a wonderful counselor and understood how we anguished. Every day she got up and said, I want to die, just like I heard. You maybe had your child tell you that. It's an anguishing as a parent to hear your child say that, I just want to die. And so this person told me yesterday she woke up one day and said, I want to live. And I feel that for my daughter now too. So I hope you just continue to roll with what comes at us, and it's not somebody else's problem, which everyone wants to think who you think you're fine. It could be you. Something could happen to you and put you over the brink, or someone very close to you could be struggling and holding it in, and it's not this somebody else's thing. So thank you for being open.
Thank you for saying that. One of the things I meant to mention is it's not going to go away if you ignore it. Family members, you guys had all talked about wanting to help. That's very good. Also, if you're a victim of mental illness, you need to address it. either through counseling or psychiatric help or, you know, something of that nature. Thank you.
One thing I forgot to say, I'd written it on my notes, was I now believe that we're all mentally ill. It's just a matter of degree and what kind. So I think you're just one very small step away from maybe being majorly mentally ill. It could happen to anybody at any time. I've known people who went their whole life, and then when they get to be 55 or 60, went into a major depression, major. And so, you know, it can happen to anybody. And that's not a very uplifting thing to say at the end, but but I do believe there's a continuum of mental illness, and we're all on there somewhere.
I'd like to mention one last thing. Richard is the chair, president, whatever you want to call it, of All's Fair Kansas, the board that's helping to promote, educate, and raise funds for the marriage equality fight that we're engaged in. So here's someone finishing up his master's degree, doing really important work in the world, out there campaigning for good people, for races, and their whole family's involved with the politics. So this can happen in very positive and powerful ways. Now let us stand as you are able, and let us sing Bright Those Jewels, 132. Let me share these closing words. Remember that the universe is so much larger than our ability to comprehend. Let us go forth from this time together with the resolve to stop trying to reduce the incomprehensible to our own petty expectations, so that wonder, that sense of what is sacred, can find space to open up our minds, illumine our lives, and expand our hearts. There is a deepening UU class for anybody who's interested at 12:15. Let's go have coffee together.